I did have one question for counsel for the respondent, the appellant. We're a few minutes ahead of schedule. Were we waiting for anyone, Mr. Saunders, to listen?
I don't believe so. I think my client was trying to get in, but I think we're fine in proceeding.
All right, then. Ms. Hunt, anyone from your side?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
All right, then I think we will. Well, it is right on the dot. So our next case this morning is, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Mary Skarsten-Dinerman versus Milton Skarsten Living Trust, case file 821-0280. As all parties are aware, we are doing this by Zoom. The court does have its own recording of the arguments, but it is strictly prohibited for anyone observing or anyone else who's out there to make their own copies. And, you know, that is very serious, so please comply with that rule. Counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes. And then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, please begin and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Saunders from the law firm of Anderson Larson in Wilmer, Minnesota, and I represent the petitioner, Mary Skarsten-Dinerman, in this matter. This case is somewhat unique in that it takes a look at the new trust code, which was adopted in 2015. I think respondent and appellant agree that the court can modify a irrevocable trust under certain circumstances. It appears that we do have a disagreement as to the standard of review for the court today. So I want to address that first of all. We believe that the two statutes, 501C.0411 and 0412, by their nature, require the court to interpret the trust. And even the respondent agreed in their brief that when the court interprets a contract, or in this case, a trust, it's de novo review. The cases cited by the respondent actually predated 2015 in this statute, and they dealt with modification, which was previously by common law. So we believe that under the current statute, where 0411 requires a review the modification furthers the purposes of the trust. The court had to determine the purpose. The trial court attempted to do that, but we believe that this court can do that on a de novo review. And we believe that 0412 also requires the court to determine the purpose. And so we think the proper standard review is de novo by this court. Getting into statute, which is 0411, which indicates that a non-charitable irrevocable trust may be modified upon the consent of all the beneficiaries, which we have in this case. I represent the petitioner, but also all of the beneficiaries are joining in this attempt to modify the trust. And if the court concludes that modification is not inconsistent with the material purpose of the trust, it appears that the trial court and the respondent would say that the material purpose of the trust is that the land never be sold. And we would argue that the material purpose of the trust is to care for the beneficiaries. And we believe that that's stated several times. One of the unique
things. So then you suggest that the court simply ignore paragraph 9, which seems to fairly clearly prohibit the modification that you're seeking.
Well, and that's the first issue. Thank you for that question. Our petition was modified to request that the land be distributed, and that is allowed by the trust. The difference is it says distribution should occur when there's a death of three of the beneficiaries. In this situation, the trial court focused on only the initial petition, which asked for a sale. There is a prohibition of a sale, but if the primary purpose is to care for the beneficiaries, and an analysis of what the request is, is consistent with how the eventual termination of the trust will occur. There's no distinction as to which child is going to die first. There's no explanation in the trust as to why there's a magic number of three children passing away before all of the property is distributed to the three remaining children.
And Mr. So, Saunders, going back to Judge Bjorkman's question, isn't what you're proposing directly contrary to the to Milton's intent when he specified that that land is to be held until the death of the third beneficiary? And so, which is in paragraph 6D. So when you read the trust as a whole, and I agree with you that, you know, reading the trust, our review is de novo. It's a legal question interpreting the trust. But when you read the trust as a whole, I think it's clear that the intent of the trust is that the land be held until the death of the third beneficiary. Now, you may not think that's the most equitable approach. Others may not think that's the equitable approach, but our role here is not to determine what is the most equitable approach. Our, you know, the court's role below was to interpret the trust to determine whether modification will further the purposes of the trust, and in doing so, the court interpreted the trust. And in looking at the trust again here, it seems what you're proposing is directly contrary to the plain language of the trust and the settler's intent, as evidenced by the plain language of the trust.
Right, and the distinction I want to draw, Judge Cochran, is that the purpose wasn't that the land never be sold, although that's what the clear admonition is, right? But the purpose was that his children would be cared for. And it's my position
it doesn't say, I don't see that. I don't see a general purpose to care for the children. I mean, what you're saying is the court should have interpreted this general purpose and ignored the specifics of the trust, which evidenced the grant, the settler's intent.
Here's what I'm looking at, Judge. Paragraph 6 of the Declaration of Trust, paragraph B, says that after payment of these debts, and this is after the death of Mr. Scarson, the remaining balance of each share of the trust estate, including any accumulation but undistributed income, shall be retained in trust for the benefit of the beneficiaries. And so in my mind, that is a statement that provides the purpose of the trust. The admonition that you focused on in the admonition that it can never be sold is a function of how he wanted to care for the trust. But if I could point to 041.
Mr. Saunders, I don't think I said that it can never be sold. I was pointing to the language of the trust that specifically identifies the time of distribution. And I think you have to read paragraph B in conjunction with paragraph D, along with paragraph 9, which Judge Bjorkman pointed to. So reading those three together, how is distributing, I mean, I think those three make clear the material purpose of the trust as found by the district court is to, you know, retain that property in accordance with Milton's intent, and that the property provide annual payments to the beneficiaries.
Right. And I think what I was referring to is paragraph 9, which says, except as expressly permitted by this paragraph, no sale of real estate included in the trust estate shall be permitted after my death. That's pretty clear as to his admonition. But the reason I'm focusing on point 0412 is the reason for the new trust law is the legislature decided that there may be changes that occur which would make an irrevocable trust that has an admonition like you've described in this case and which is here, not for the purpose of the trust. If the purpose of the trust is to care for the children and for some reason the land was unable to be rented and not generated any income, that would not further the purpose of taking care of Mr. Scarston's children, it would be furthering the purpose of his admonition that the land could never be sold. And another example would be farmland is increasing in value, and yet the rental payments are really staying generally the same out here. And so if the land doubled in value, instead of earning 2.5% interest, that interest rate would be cut in half. There are certain circumstances, and I think this is why the legislature provided 0412, which would allow a court to say, that might have made sense in 2003 when this trust was drafted, but unfortunately, the economy, the value of land, the ag economy have made modifications. In this case, the prior judge did not make a determination concerning that primary purpose that we've talked about and whether it could be adjusted as time goes on.
Well, didn't the judge find that the material purpose, and I'm looking at paragraph 2 of the conclusions of law, is that the realty property remain in the trust remain unsold, providing annual payments to the beneficiaries. And the judge later recognized, you know, the exception for payments upon, as necessary upon his death, that sale is permitted then. But how is that finding of material purpose inconsistent with the plain language of the trust?
Well, first of all, one of the requests we had was that the property be distributed, which wouldn't have required a sale and wouldn't have been a direct violation of the provisions of the trust. And the trial court didn't address that
in issue. Distribution, that wouldn't guarantee annual payments to the beneficiaries, correct? If it was distributed, there wouldn't be any requirement for annual payments.
But Mr. Scarson did assume it would be distributed when three of his children died. So it wasn't an admonition that the children will never own the land or that it would never be distributed while his children were alive. It was a indiscriminate decision that whoever are the first three to die, the remaining three would reap the benefits, plus the heirs of the three that died if they had heirs. And so our position is if the material purpose was to never have the land sold, then his ultimate distribution provision was inconsistent with that. If his decision to have three people indiscriminately receive the benefit of that or their heirs of the decedents, how is it inconsistent to allow all of them to share in a distribution equally at this point, which would allow them to get a mortgage on the property in case they needed extra funds for their living right now? It would give them the flexibility that he contemplated would occur. We're just allowing all six of the children to gain the benefit that he eventually was going to bestow on three children and the heirs of the other decedents if they had children. And that issue wasn't
addressed. Mr. Saunders, I want to take you back to the statute that you referred to and the notion that the legislature decided in enacting the statute that a trust can be modified if circumstances change. And you posited circumstances where the land doesn't produce income. But the circumstances before the district court were that, in fact, this land continues to produce income and so is benefiting all of the children. So if that is true, then why would the district court go further under the statute and modify fairly clear terms of the trust?
And I think that it does allow, if the court looks at the factors it faces today, when land was worth $1,000 an acre and we were getting almost $100 an acre in rent, the return on that investment was good. That was the circumstances that Milton Scarston saw in 2003.
Now these land values are 7,000.
I'm sorry?
The numbers that you just referenced, are those numbers in the record?
There was no record. There's no evidentiary hearing. But the court
I'm
made
sorry.
Findings.
I mean, but this, so this argument you're making seems to be outside of the record, I guess is what I'm trying to point out.
And that would be accurate, Your Honor. But in order to determine that circumstances have changed, it's illustrative to the fact that there may be things that occur in today's a world that were not present in 2003, which I think is the basis for the legislature's.
You know, Mr. Saunders, I understand your points, but at the end of the day, if the person who set up the trust, he could have included language in it that says, well, you know, however, if the price of corn goes below this per bushel, or if the price of land goes up 100% or down to zero, all these other things could happen. So, but he didn't. So what are we supposed to do about that?
And I think that's the reason the legislature passed 0412. I have clients who come into me today and say, I want to value the land at today's value. Well, in 5 years, the value may be either higher than that or lower than that. And if they don't come into me, their trust may not really serve their original intent and purpose. And the legislature is allowing the court to analyze.
We're supposed to apply. I mean, I agree. You know what? Always good to have a good lawyer. But at the end of the day, when the trust is set up, the trust is set up. And, you know, for all we know, you know, this is the way he wanted it. And I'm not so sure we have the right to abrogate that based on what the value of land is or what the price of corn is. I mean, we're supposed to follow what the original settler set up, and that's what he did. Why am I wrong? And you can answer my question with, you know, even though you've gone over the record at the time.
And I would never indicate you're wrong. My position is that the focus...
Well, you wouldn't be the first.
My focus would be on what the purpose is. And if the purpose is his children, as opposed to this edict that he put in to satisfy his purpose, then I believe the court can modify it. And the protection for the court is 6 out of 6 of the kids believe that this would satisfy his purpose. So, you know, that is my response to you. I don't think anything you've said is wrong. I'm just saying that that is basis for our motion to the court. And we believe you have the de novo right to decide that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Saunders. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kaynard Hunt, and I represent the respondent, Paul Ganderud, who's the trustee for the Milton Scarston Living Trust. Respondent requests that the trial court's denial of modification of the trust, as well as denial of attorney's fees to appellant, be affirmed. I think it's important to point out, first of all, that appellant has conflated, especially in the reply brief, the issue whether the trust as written allows for the current sale or distribution of the property, which appellant admitted to the trial court it does not, with the separate issue whether the trust should be modified by the court to allow for sale or distribution now. I think it's important for the court to look at document 24, which was appellant's proposed amended order granting petition for modification. In paragraph 16 of appellant's proposed order, appellant states, as the beneficiaries interpret the trustee is not currently authorized to sell such real property or distribute the trust proceeds absent a modification of the trust. And a respondent agreed to do what appellant requested would require modification of the trust, which modification the trustee opposed. So when we go to the issue of with regard to modification of the trust, the issue there is whether the trial court abused its discretion. Again, appellant admitted her request for modification comes down to whether the modification is consistent with the material purpose of the trust. And if you look at the trust as a whole, its very nature and design shows its protective nature or material purpose. The material purpose was to provide a stable source of income for the 6 children by means of the land and distribute the land only after the 3 had died. And that was Mr. Scarston's decision to make. The material purpose of the trust was not just to provide for the children, but to provide for the children by means of the lands itself. So as the trial court stated at the hearing, and I quote, So he, referring to Milton Starston, was thinking they're not making any more land, and it may not be the highest return, but it will be there through good times and bad because people need to eat. And in his written order, the trial court states, quote, people will always need to eat and world population is not declining. They're not making any new land. The property is currently producing income with the rental rate increasing.
Let me stop you for a moment. I mean, there are a lot of discussion in the transcript and the order that seems to not be supported by any record. I mean, there was no evidence taken in this case. I mean, this whether modification is appropriate or not, I mean, does turn on the terms of the trust document itself, does it not? And just the circumstances of which there is no dispute in terms of the number of children still living and the fact that I think, as the respondent said in his affidavit, you know, the rental rate that's being charged and the value of the property. I mean, are there any really other, is there other evidence that would support the district court's kind of findings?
That is the evidence of record. I mean, the fact of the matter is appellant acknowledged that it had no evidence to support the modification other than looking to the terms of the trust itself. So that's where we're at.
And following up on Judge Bjorkman's question then, interpreting the terms of the trust document itself is a legal question, correct?
That is true. But when we're talking about then modification of the trust, in all of the case law of this court and the Supreme Court, that is an abuse of discretion. But in terms of
in considering whether there's an abuse of discretion, we consider whether there's an error of law. And in determining whether there's an error of law, we conduct de novo review, correct?
That is correct.
So in my earlier statement to Mr. Saunders about the standard of review, I was referring to our interpretation of the trust document itself being de novo. Would you agree with that? Go ahead.
That's correct. What's interesting
under the general abuse of discretion framework.
That is correct. What's interesting is there is a Minnesota Supreme Court decision, Mervin versus Magny Construction, which is at 416 Northwest 2nd at 123. And there, what happened there is the document was characterized by the trial court as ambiguous, and there was no extrinsic evidence presented as to meaning. Then the Supreme Court said, well, then the trial court properly treats the construction before it as a question of law. And then on appeal, what the court looks to is, according to the Supreme Court, the party claiming error bears the burden of proof that the trial court committed error. So, I mean, following that kind of analysis, I mean, there is no error here.
Would you agree that the trust document is unambiguous in terms of its material purpose?
It is unambiguous in terms of its material purpose. The argument of ambiguity, as put forth by the appellant, was a claimed ambiguity between the paragraph regarding no sale after the death and then the paragraph regarding distribution. But there isn't any ambiguity there. I mean, the fact of the matter is that after you have the third beneficiary die, then the trust assets are distributed and then they do with whatever. So, I mean, that's how the trust is set up.
And with regard to paragraph 7, that allows one of the daughters the exclusive right to occupy a building site. My reading of that section is that basically, you know, even at the time of distribution, it can't be sold without her consent. That, you know, so the consent goes to whether, you know, basically it's saying she has the absolute right to occupy that piece of property during his life, after his death, and even at the time of distribution.
That's my reading of it, too. So what happens is if he's alive, he can't sell it without her written consent. And if it goes to distribution, however it's distributed, she still has to consent to the sale.
Does that create an ambiguity?
No. And matter of fact, it was interesting because appellant never asserted to the trial court that it did. That provision was not the claimed ambiguity. So if the court goes back, and that's why I think it's interesting to look at document 24 to see exactly how it was presented to the trial court by the petitioner, because in document 24, they're claiming the ambiguity is what I said was between the, if you look at paragraph 19 of their proposed order, they're saying it's the ambiguity was between the no sale provision and then the distribution provision. They didn't assert any other provision in the proposed order for the trial court created any kind of ambiguity. So what we're asking this court is to affirm the district court in that as the trial court found nothing has fundamentally changed since Mr. Scarston made his value judgment in setting up the trust as he did. His concern was true for all his children, not just for the three children who now have special needs trust, to have the farm as the source of the income. Matter of fact, if you look at paragraph 10 of the trust, it shows that Milton Scarston was concerned that his children may not make prudent financial decisions, as it states the trustee may exercise his judgment to make the beneficiary's distribution to a relative if that beneficiary is not able to apply the distribution in their best interest. So it's hard to understand how the special needs trust in any respect changes or would somehow promotes a modification here. Also, under appellant's proposal, the land would be sold or distributed to each of the six children immediately. Those with special needs trust would have their shares put in the special needs trust, but then when they die, the estate would have the ability to seek reimbursement from the special needs trust. So what appellant is suggesting, you exchange the possibility the state might have an interest in the trust assets, depending on who dies first, with the certainty that it will not have, well, that it will have an interest in the smaller portion of the trust assets. And there's no evidence that that's the result Scarston would have wanted. As to the evidentiary hearing, appellants didn't request one. In fact, they admitted they had nothing to offer other than the trust document itself. Specifically, appellant's counsel stated to the trial court, it's clear that we don't have any evidence related to the purpose of the trust. We'd have to look at the trust itself and see if our requested relief is consistent with that trust. So there's no abuse of discretion not holding an evidentiary hearing here. And then turning to the last issue, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying an award of attorney's fees to appellant.
How can we get there, counsel, when there are no findings? I mean, you would agree that the law would, you know, conceivably permits a district court to make an attorney fee award to a beneficiary who has initiated an action. And we just have sort of the blanket, the trust shall not be ordered to pay it. What findings do we have to review? How can we tell if the court abused its discretion?
You can do it for the same reason the Minnesota Supreme Court did in In re Campbell at 258 Northwest 2nd at 867. Their petitioners were denied attorney's fees without explanation, which petitioners challenged on appeal, citing Atwood, which states that attorney's fees can be awarded in the sound and cautiously exercised discretion in the court and not as a matter of right. And to allow for fees, the trust instruments must be sufficiently ambiguous as to require litigation establishing the meaning and effect. There, the Supreme Court affirmed the denial of no fees, which had been denied without explanation.
But here we have a finding by the district court that, in fact, the trust was ambiguous.
But it's immaterial because the appellant acknowledged that regardless of the ambiguity they were asserting, they acknowledged in their petition and in their proposed order that under their interpretation of the trust, that the farm could not be sold or the trust could not be distributed. So their claim of ambiguity really was irrelevant because both parties agreed that based on the terms of the trust, what they were requesting could not be done under the terms of the trust. You'd have to modify the terms of the trust. So the ambiguity argument is really, you know, it really doesn't get them anywhere. So
also, did respondent agree below that reasonable costs and expenses should have been paid by the trust?
It did. And then what happened is you had a separate proposed order put forward by petitioner. And in that proposed order, if the court looks at paragraph 16 of that, they assert that an award of expenses and attorney's fees to the petitioners appropriated on the circumstances based upon the efforts undertaken by the petitioner to successfully modify the trust for the benefit of all the trust beneficiaries. So what you had is the appellant coming before the trial court and specifically saying to the trial court, give me my attorney's fees based on the fact that I'm successful in modifying the trust, which obviously didn't happen. So given the own assertion by the appellant, I don't know how there can be an abuse of discretion here. And it really doesn't matter what the respondent said with regard to attorney's fees. Ultimately, the question for the court is whether the trial court abused its discretion in denying fees here, and it did not. I mean, the litigation was not necessary to resolve the meaning of any ambiguous language because both sides agreed that the trust did not allow for the current sale or distribution of the land. An adjudication was not essential to the proper administration of the trust, and the litigation was not conducted for the primary benefit of the trust as a whole. So there is no abuse of discretion here in denying fees, and respondent respectfully requests affirmance.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hunt. Mr. Saunders, you'll have the last word. You're muted, Mr. Saunders.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Getting back to the original question concerning Judge Glasrud's conclusions of law, he states cash rent does not represent a spectacular return on investment, but it is steady, and by and large, a principal investment is safe. Certainly, Milton Skarsten saw it this way. There's nothing in the record to indicate what Milton Skarsten saw or intended. And in 2003, this might have been an absolute correct,
except for the actual trust itself, set up the way he set it up. I mean, at some point, you know, I always try to tell my clerks that, you know, we also apply common sense here. I mean, he set up the trust the way he set up, and it would suggest he set it up precisely the way Ms. Hunt said he did. You know, land is God, a little bit of income, three kids go, distribute the land. He was a farmer. I mean, I fail to see what is so confusing about the why, what, how he set up the trust the way he set it up.
It's not confusing at all. The question is, did the legislature intend that we would never change a trust for any reason? We think that the statute...
Well, Mr. Saunders, then we look at the statute, right? And the statute says under 501c.0411 paragraph B that a non-charitable irrevocable trust may be modified on the consent of all beneficiaries if the court concludes that modification is not inconsistent with the material purpose of the trust. And so we look to the trust itself and determine the material purpose, as Judge Conley was just discussing. Given that, how can we conclude that the district court abused its discretion in interpret, you know, in this matter?
And I wasn't referencing that statute, Your Honor. I was referencing 501C0412, which says the court may modify the administrative or dispositive terms of a trust or terminate the trust if, because of circumstances not anticipated by the settlor, modification or termination will further the purposes of the trust. And it's my position that the court was making a determination that it was consistent with his thoughts in 2020 as it was in 2003. And I think that our position is that times change, values of land changes, rental values change. And maybe if Milton Scarson was alive today, he would change his trust. And the legislature has allowed this role to allow courts to analyze the circumstances today to determine if it furthers his purpose of the trust, which is to care for his children.
Again, though, it has to, the change, the modification has to further the purpose of the trust, correct?
Correct.
So then we get back to the trust document itself, not some speculation as to what he might have wanted to do today.
Well, what I've stated, and I believe it's true, is his purpose was to take care of his children. And he, that has to be analyzed as time goes
certain,
on.
In a certain way that the trust specifies. If the trust is always just, well, it's going to benefit whoever the beneficiaries are, I mean, you know, why have a trust? He set it up the way he set it up. And I mean, I think it would be defy common sense to suggest this guy didn't know that the price of corn goes up and down, you know, over 20 or 30 years. So I honestly don't see how the district court erred in this case by applying the plain language of the trust, which seemed to be in accordance with how it was set up. And I don't see an error here. Why am I wrong?
If the position of the court is once a trust is created, it can never be modified, then 0412 has no effect. Because 0412 allows this. You may disagree with it in this case, but it's our position that 0412 was designed to handle, what if it's a 1919 trust where changes have occurred in the world? This provides for those changes and allows this to happen because sometimes people make a decision in 2003 that they wouldn't make in 2021. And that's
Mr.
my
Saunders,
position.
Just to clarify, I don't think it's the position of this court that a trust cannot be modified under the statute. I think we're trying to focus on the purpose of the trust as evidenced by the trust itself.
And the further protection of the statute requires every beneficiary to agree, which is another further protection that we're just willy-nilly going to change somebody's donative intent. And with that, I'll close. I think my time must be up. So thank you
very much, Ms. Saunders. Thank you, Ms. Hunt. The matter is submitted.